there's room for everyone, and the good earth is rich and can provide for everyone. The way of life can be free and beautiful, but we have lost the way. Greed has poisoned men's souls, has barricaded the world with hate. We think too much and feel too little.
Hello, friends. It is Tuesday. It is June 2nd, 2015. This is Deanna Spingola, and I'm subbing for Clint Richardson on the Corporation Nation. His websites are realityblogger.wordpress.com and thecorporationnation.com. He is the producer of the Corporation Nation and Lethal Injection, the Story of Vaccination, and Kaffir School, School Districts, and the Lottery. His latest movie is Common Core, Agenda 21, and Global Privatization. During this program, email your questions or comments to comment@spingola.com. We have two chat rooms open tonight, CorporationNation.chattango.com and Spingola.chattango.com. We will take calls later on in the program at 800-313-9443. Please do wait until we open the phone lines. Inasmuch as Clint talks a lot about corporations, I thought that is what I'm going to discuss tonight and possibly for the rest of the week. And I'm going to first start off talking about the FDA. And that's something that we see a lot about in the news and the alternative media lately. I'm subscribed to a lot of lists. I got an email today from the Alliance, the Pulse of Natural Health, and there's three subjects that they cover. The FDA fires direct shot at small, local, and artisanal food producers. Another title is Bad Vaccine Bill on the Fast Track in California, and Government Data on Vaccine Issues, something that I am always interested in, and so I subscribe to a lot of lists that cover those subjects. Alrighty, talking about the FDA. Before 1962, the FDA approved drugs for safety only. After pregnant women in Europe had taken thalidomide that resulted in numerous severe birth defects, Congress required the drug manufacturers, in addition to safety, also prove the efficacy of their products before the FDA would approve those drugs for marketing. Government agencies and other special interests encouraged drug companies to develop disease-specific drugs that only AMA-licensed physicians could prescribe. These physicians, now drug agents, were trained in America's medical schools by people affiliated with the pharmaceutical industry. Doctors thereafter focused on the treatment of diseases rather than on helping people naturally maintain their health. The worldwide thalidomide crisis dramatically changed healthcare. On October 10, 1962, JFK signed the Kefauver-Harris Amendment, also known as the Drug Amendments Act, into law. This was an amendment to the Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act of 1938, which explicitly stated that the FDA would rely on scientific testing and that new drug approvals would be based not only upon proof of safety, but also on substantial evidence of a drug's efficacy. The new law necessitated randomized clinical trials, RCTs, and standardized the criteria and the methodology by which drug companies conducted them. Yet, trials are expensive, which increase the development expenditures and force the corporate evolution of the pharmaceutical industry. The FDA's alleged mission is, and I quote, to promote and protect the public health by helping safe and effective products reach the market in a timely way and monitoring products for continued safety after they are in use, unquote. According to the FDA, and I quote, at the heart of all the FDA's product evaluation and decisions is a judgment about whether a new product's benefits to users will outweigh the risks. No regulated product is totally risk-free, so these judgments are important. FDA will allow a product to present more of a risk when its potential benefit is great, especially for products used to treat serious life-threatening conditions. And that was also a quote. Now, I want you to think about all of the side effects mentioned in the numerous advertisements that we see on TV. Those ads serve as a public notice that one may not sue a drug company because of side effects, as the drug maker has issued a public warning. And of course, they expect everyone, rather than look at the images on the screen, they expect everyone that might suggest to their doctors that they would like to try this or that drug. They just hope that that's what you will do and not worry about those side effects. After all, side effects are things that happen to other people, not to me, of course, not to you, of course. Even in the mid-70s, the federal government accommodated Big Pharma. A military recruit became ill and died a few days later, while 200 other recruits in Fort Dix, New Jersey, got sick but recovered. In March 1976, CDC Director Dr. David J. Sencer, S-E-N-C-E-R, noted for his smallpox operation in Central Africa and other decision makers at the CDC panicked over this outbreak. Okay, remember, there were 200 other recruits at Fort Dix that got sick, they recovered, okay? But they made this big deal out of one recruit, one person. I'm sure he was very important to his family and friends, but they said, oh, this was an outbreak. And so they directed the Public Health Service, the PHS, to request about 200 million doses of vaccine and persuaded President Ford. Now remember that he was the first appointed president to have not even run in a presidential election. Anyway, they persuaded President Gerald Ford to call for the National Influenza Immunization Program, during which over 40 million Americans received the flu vaccine. Ford declared that every, and I quote, every man, woman, and child, unquote, should be vaccinated. The taxpayers paid $137 million to the pharmaceutical companies for the vaccine. The campaign ran from early October, but ended in December after cases of Guillain-Barré syndrome came to light, presumably caused by the vaccine. In 1979, people learned that 25 people died from the vaccine and 500 Americans contracted Guillain-Barré syndrome, a paralyzing neurological disease. And I believe that that Ford even received a vaccination with probably a saline solution. He did receive a vaccination right on television to encourage the rest of us to run out and get ours. After all, the taxpayers had paid $137 million to the pharmaceutical companies for the vaccine. Now, a drug maker may approach the FDA numerous times for the approval of a drug after the company's failure to, and I quote, prove the efficacy and the safety of a drug, unquote. The FDA will approve the drug, and I quote, if there is an indication of a possible desired effect, unquote. A drug company classifies deaths that occur during a clinical trial as trade secrets. And for that reason, the company does not have to disclose those deaths to the FDA authorities. The whole procedure serves to immunize the pharmaceutical industry and not the interest of the patient. The president-appointed FDA commissioner directs the agency, currently located in the Federal Research Center at White Oak. It operates under the DHHS and has 223 field offices and 13 laboratories throughout America, in the Virgin Islands, in Puerto Rico, and in 2008 it opened offices in India, Costa Rica, Chile, Belgium, England, and China, perhaps to implement global objectives in conjunction with the World Bank and Gavi. Theoretically, this unelected bureaucracy regulates and supervises food safety, tobacco products, dietary supplements, prescription and over-the-counter preparations, vaccines, blood transfusions, biopharmaceuticals, medical devices, electromagnetic radiation emitting devices, veterinary products, and cosmetics. Given that live disease-causing viruses and mercury are in vaccines, that debilitating fluoride is in our water, and that the neurotoxin aspartame is in our food, it seems patently obvious that the FDA protects corporate interest at the expense of public health. David Rockefeller met with other Republicans to develop a strategy to halt Ronald Reagan's presidential campaign, despite the fact that he supported big business and big oil. But Reagan was just too popular. The day after his campaign victory in New Hampshire, establishment lawyer William Casey, who was a member of the CFR, became his campaign manager, and George H.W. Bush became Reagan's running mate. Now, George H.W. Bush has for a long time been affiliated with, well, drugs. Not the legal ones, of course, but illegal drugs. And then thereafter, George H.W. Bush he sat on the boards of some of the legal drug companies, I believe, including Eli Lilly. Anyway, after the election, the transition team, was composed of 28 CFR members, and Reagan ultimately appointed more than 80 individuals who belonged either to the CFR, the Council on Foreign Relations, or to the Trilateral Commission, which of course was created by David Rockefeller and a few other insiders, and including the neophyte Carter. Jimmy Carter was one of the first members, one of the charter members. Now, despite Reagan's campaign promise to balance the budget, in genuine Keynesian style, with congressional approval, he increased the debt more than all former presidents combined, though he was allegedly against big government and taxation. He raised taxes on Social Security and gasoline in the biggest single tax increase in the nation's history. Policies within the FDA changed drastically when Reagan formally took office on January 20th, 1981. Previously, in 1973, despite studies showing the horrific health risks, Sirley, it was a drug company, submitted over 100 safety studies and applied for FDA approval. Dr. Martha Freeman of the FDA said that Sirley had provided inadequate research or information about the toxic breakdown of the product, diketotopiperazine, DKP. Dr. John Olney, a professor, and they were trying to get aspartame through. Anyway, he's a professor. Olney was a professor of psychiatry and neuropathology. James Turner was an attorney, and legal action for buyer's education and labeling filed a formal objection to aspartame's FDA approval. So you have three people. You have Dr. John Olney, who is a professor of psychiatry and neuropathology. You had James Turner, an attorney, and then you had a group called Legal Action for Buyer's Education and Labeling, and they together filed a formal objection to aspartame's FDA approval, citing evidence that it could cause brain damage. In July 1973, President Richard M. Nixon, before his fall from grace on August 9, 1974, asked Caspar W. Weinberger, the Health, Education, and Welfare Secretary, to appoint Alexander M. Schmidt as FDA Commissioner. In 1974, that was the same year that Kissinger's NSSM 200, which was the National Security Memorandum, was released. Well, anyway, in 1974, Schmidt approved of aspartame as a food additive in dry goods. In 1975, concerned over Sirley's submission to the FDA, he created a task force that prompted Sirley to withdraw the product from the market. The task force issued a 500-page report proving Sirley's clinical irregularities. In the same year, Jerome Bresler formed another task force to look into the indiscretions in Sirley's aspartame studies uncovered by Schmidt's group. For 16 years, Sirley had failed to get FDA approval because the agency felt that the company's product was completely unsafe to the point that it wanted to indict Sirley for fraud. On January 10, 1977, FDA Chief Counsel Richard Merrill wrote a 33-page letter to U.S. Attorney Samuel Skinner detailing violations of the law that a grand jury be set up to investigate G.D. Sirley. In the letter, Merrill stated, and I quote, "We request that your office convene a grand jury investigation into apparent violations of the Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act, which is 21 U.S.C. 331E, and the False Reports to the Government Act, which is 18 U.S.C. 1001, by G.D. Searley and Company, and three of its responsible officers for their willing and knowing failure and for concealing material facts and making false statements in reports of animal studies conducted to establish the safety of the drug aldactone and the food additive aspartame." A grand jury under Skinner's leadership began the investigation. Searley's law firm, Sidley and Austin, offered Skinner what must have been a very plush position at their firm. William Conlon then assumed Skinner's jurisdiction over the grand jury because, well, Skinner obviously sold out. Conlon procrastinated until the statute of limitations on aspartame expired. They dropped the investigation. Searley pressured the FDA to convene another task force headed by Jacqueline Verrett to review the negative Bressler report. Subsequently, the FDA exonerated Searley of, and I quote, "any wrongdoing in its testing procedures." In 1987, Verrett would testify in a Senate committee that, and I quote, "her team was forced into validating data from experiments that were clearly a disaster," unquote. In 1979, the FDA convened a public board of inquiry to review the objections and issues that only and Turner had raised. Only reiterated, and I quote, "that the FDA has a special obligation to protect children and that there is no margin of safety for the use of aspartame in the child's diet," unquote. Dr. Olney warned the FDA. He said, "Aspartame will contribute to the incidence and severity of mental retardation in fetuses and children," unquote. Apparently, Dr. Olney was sufficiently persuasive that the FDA, then attempting to protect the nation's children, voted unanimously against aspartame's approval, unquote. Donald Rumsfeld was the U.S. ambassador to NATO from 1973 to 1974, then the chief of staff in the Ford administration, you know, where they pushed those flu shots from 1974 to 75, and then defense secretary from 75 to 77. He then became CEO, president, and then chairman of the G.D. Searley Company. And he remained in that office from 1977 through 1985. James Turner claimed Searley hired Rumsfeld to handle the aspartame approval difficulties as a legal problem rather than a scientific problem. According to a former Searley salesperson, Patty Wood Allott, Rumsfeld told his sales force that, if necessary, and I quote, "he would call in all his markers and that no matter what, he would see to it that aspartame would be approved that year." Rumsfeld, for his efforts, received a $12 million bonus from Searley. The very day after pro-business Reagan took office, Sirley reapplied for the approval of aspartame, along with several new studies. Some people believe that Reagan would replace Jerguyen, the FDA commissioner. Those new studies concealed the injurious results and horrendous health risks of the company's previous studies. The HEW, the Department of Health and Human Resources, is that what that stands for? Sometimes you have so many things that, let's see, HEW, health and, anyway, I'll have to look that up later. This is the important thing. It became the Department of Health and Human Services, and that is DHHS. Anyway, it became they changed the name of the department to the DHHS in 1980. Reagan immediately appointed Richard Swiker as the DHHS secretary on January 22nd, 1981, well, the day after he took office. Swiker immediately appointed Dr. Arthur Hull Hayes, an American pharmacologist and a Rhodes Scholar, as the FDA commissioner. Now, Hayes' father, Arthur Hull Hayes Sr., was the president of CBS Radio. Hayes took office on April 13, 1981, and quickly overruled an FDA Board of Inquiry and approved aspartame. He would leave the FDA on September 11, 1983, and become the dean of the New York Medical College, and later the president of EM Pharmaceuticals, Inc. Okay, so I think we're coming up on a break here just momentarily. But anyway, in 1983, Dr. Woodrow Monty, a pediatrician board certified in pediatrics and integrative holistic medicine, and Turner petitioned the FDA for a hearing to discuss the dangers of aspartame. The FDA responded that, and I quote, "The studies demonstrated the safety of aspartame's components," unquote. Monty and Turner also asked the CDC to investigate the numerous cases of aspartame's adverse reactions as reported to the FDA, including aggressive behavior, disorientation, hyperactivity, memory loss, seizures, mood swings, cardiac arrest, liver impairment, suicidal tendencies, and death. We'll be right back.
Don't concentrate on the finger or you will miss all that heavenly glory.
I am subbing for Clint tonight, and somebody in the chat room gave me what HEW. It's Health, Education, and Welfare. So thank you, and also Cyril is, well, you don't pronounce E. A lot of times readers like myself, they don't necessarily, well, they just look at a word and they don't really know how to pronounce it. And so I find that that's, well, that's one of my things. I read too much without looking at words and how to pronounce them. Okay. Anyway, the aspartame's adverse restrictions as reported to the FDA, and remember that about only less than 1% of the people report adverse reactions. But anyway, those included aggressive behavior, disorientation, hyperactivity, memory loss, seizures, mood swings, cardiac arrest, liver impairment, suicidal tendencies, and death. In 1994, the CDC and the FDA compiled a report that described all the adverse reactions from aspartame, which then consisted of 75% of the complaints in the monitoring system. I believe that Dr. Betty Martini has that list now contains, I think it's like 92, 91 adverse reactions. Anyway, by 1995, there would be 10,000 complaints about aspartame, and it is still in the food, despite all those complaints. In 1985, Monsanto, founded in 1901 by pharmacist John Francis Quinney, purchased Cyril for $2.7 billion. Quinney's father-in-law was Emmanuel Mendez de Monsanto, a wealthy financier of a sugar company. Some of Monsanto's first producers, or first products, were food additives like saccharin, caffeine, and vanillin. In the 1960s, Monsanto became one of the producers of Agent Orange, along with Dow Chemicals, who makes napalm, Uniroyal, and other companies. Monsanto's Agent Orange contained higher levels of dioxin than that produced by the other companies. Operation Ranch Hand, which ran from 1962 to 1971, sprayed 6 million acres of forest, along with thousands of U.S. military personnel serving, quote-unquote, in Vietnam, with 19 million gallons of defoliant. President George H.W. Bush appointed David Kessler as the FDA commissioner from 1990 to 1997. He gave aspartame full approval to be used as a sweetener in everything. In 1997, Kessler left the FDA and became the dean of the Yale School of Medicine. He was in that position from 1997 to 2003. When George W. Bush became president, he appointed Linda J. Fisher, a former Monsanto vice president and one of their lobbyists, to be the second highest position in the EPA, Environmental Protection Agency. Huh. When the initial version stevia was introduced, its distributor created a cookbook with directions on how to use the sweetener instead of sugar. The FDA directed him to destroy the cookbooks. Now, they proved of aspartame, but stevia, well, they didn't want any competition, healthy competition. The FDA directed him to destroy the cookbooks and actually sent agents to his warehouse to supervise the burning of these benign books. At that time, one of the FDA's decision makers had a financial interest in NutraSweet, a competitor to the newly introduced stevia. Reportedly, the original version of stevia has since been compromised and is now under the FDA's control. On another occasion, with the help of local law enforcement, the FDA sent a SWAT team to the office of Dr. Jonathan Wright, an expert in alternative and nutritional medicine, to confiscate quote-unquote dangerous drugs, which turned out to be injectable vitamins. About 140 million people in the United States regularly use vitamins and minerals. There have been 2,500 adverse events annually that one might attribute to vitamins, but deaths rarely, if ever, occur from supplement use. However, each year, according to the FDA's website, those are the official records, people, about 2.2 million people experience serious adverse drug reactions, ADRs, and they reported those adverse reactions to, and these were to FDA-approved prescriptions written by AMA-licensed physicians. Doctors staff the panels that approve of these drugs. In nursing homes, the yearly ADR, adverse drug reactions, the average yearly ADR rate is 350,000. And those are only the ones that are reported each year, and they're vastly underreported. Each year, 100,000 people perish because of ADRs. Some authorities say the figure is 106,000. This is criminal. Yet no one is arrested, prosecuted, sued, censured, or fired despite the admitted killing of thousands of people each year. This is corporate criminality, and the media covers it up. Okay, let me just check in the chat room, see if there's any questions. Let's see, no questions. No questions. Oh, I got to check in the other chat room, see if there's any. Okay, let me just check email, see if there's any email questions. Alrighty. Now, we can open the phone lines for callers. We can take some callers. We're coming up on the second hour. Why don't we wait until the second hour? We'll take callers then. Alrighty. Okay. So there's a lot of deaths, but is anybody, do we hear that in the media? No. We do hear it from people who have investigated these things. Alrighty. Now I'm going to talk about the commercialization of government-funded inventions. And this is, people have often heard about the public-private partnerships. And those are also, those also occur, where pharmaceuticals are concerned. Now, former spokesperson for General Electric, pro-corporation Ronald Reagan, the former governor of California from 1967 to 1975, was elected as president from 1981 to 1989. Now, the president also functions as the CEO of a corporation called U.S. Arms. Let me read you a document from that. Well, actually, it was from Bill Clinton. And let's see, it was when he was president. And he says, and he is the CEO of U.S. Arms. Okay. Strong growth in lean years is the hallmark of competitiveness, and U.S. Arms has had a very competitive year. Some shareholders were worried by my campaign promise to press for strong international limits on the dangerous and wasteful flow of weapons to troubled regions. But I assure you, now this, I'm going to relate this to what I'm, the information I'm going to tell you, but I assure you that I have held fast to the course set by former CEOs Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush. The end of the Cold War has caused a drop in both domestic and global arms demand. U.S. Arms has responded by spending shareholder money to develop export markets in Asia and the Middle East. As a result, our share of global conventional arms agreements rose from 17% in 1988 to 70% in 1993. And thanks to the efforts of our marketing team, the majority of our 1993 sales were to a promising new market, the developing world. In order to ensure stability, unelected governments and developing countries feel the need to acquire more arms. We are reaching out to them vigorously. Where we once catered to Cold War political allegiances, we now aggressively respond to supply and demand, with Russia, our major competitor, still severely crippled. We can look forward to several years of spectacular growth. So, and that will also include, well, pharmaceuticals. Not only the arms, but pharmaceuticals, because remember that the U.S. president is also the president of that corporation called U.S. Arms. Now, the Reagan administration applied its pro-business mentality to government policies as well as to the nation's moral values in general. People began viewing health or wealth as the ultimate objective. And if one had money, he or she could also have power, particularly political power, even if it was detrimental to others. Previously, most scientists and academics focused on innovative research and negatively regarded those who abandoned nobler, more virtuous objectives and catered to industry for the almighty corporate dollar. The pharmaceutical industry took a giant leap forward during the Reagan years due to corporate and government cronyism and the legislation that benefited business. Even before Reagan took office in January, a lame duck, a lame duck Congress passed the Bayh-Dole Act, and this was created by Birch Bayh and Bob Dole. This law made it possible for universities and small businesses sponsored by the taxpayer-funded NIH, which is the National Institutes for Health, to patent their medical-centered inventions and discoveries, and then award exclusive licenses for production to drug companies. When the citizens, via their tax dollars, finance something, then it should remain in the public domain. However, the law promotes the commercialization of government-funded inventions and transfers the title of them to universities and other contractors, including the drug companies. This constitutes complicity between the drug industry, the government, and ivory tower doctors at the expense of the American public. Allegedly, the industry spends 30 plus billion on research and development. And that is the reason that Big Pharma has to charge such high prices. However, the industry actually develops very few innovative drugs. The majority of the newly marketed drugs are the result of publicly supported research subsidized by the NIH, the National Institutes of Health. Scientists conduct research at universities, biotechnology companies, medical schools, teaching hospitals, or at the NIH, a government agency, all made possible with the enactment of the Bayh-Dole Act in conjunction with the Stevenson-Whittler Act, the first major technology transfer law signed into law by Jimmy Carter on October 21st, 1980. I believe we're going to a break momentarily. This law permitted the federally funded laboratories to transfer technology and an exclusive license to the drug companies in exchange for royalties. Drug companies then patent and market the drugs for additional uses. Sometimes they acquire the drugs before they reach the clinical trial stage. We'll be right back. Alrighty, we are back. This is Deanna, and I'm subbing for Clint tonight. And anyway, as I was telling you, the legislation that was put into play by Congress and signed by the president, even as far back as Jimmy Carter, on these major technology transfers, allowed this, the laws permitted federally funded, in other words, taxpayer-funded laboratories to transfer, to give technology, and to give exclusive licenses to the drug companies in exchange for royalties. In other words, the drug companies can make billions of dollars selling drugs that were paid by, in the development by taxpayers, and the federal agencies would be able to collect royalties. Now the drug companies then patent and market the drugs for additional uses. In other words, they could develop a drug for one thing and then they could sell it off-label for something else, and they make, well, billions of dollars. And sometimes they acquire the drugs before they are even tested in a clinical trial. Now, before Congress passed Bayh-Dole, the Supreme Court for the first time allowed a patent on a living organism. Ananda Mohan Chakrabarty, a scientist at General Electric, created a genetically engineered bacterium capable of breaking down crude oil. Patents give inventors a monopoly on their creations and prohibit competitors from marketing those products for 20 years. The justices argued the case on March 17, 1980, and made their decision on June 16, 1980. The U.S. Patent and Trademark Office granted a patent on March 31, 1981. The court's decision, now this goes back quite a few years, the court's decision overturned the long-standing policy of the Patent Office that stated that no one could patent living things. This ruling allowed for, and I quote, the patenting of genes, cell lines, tissues, and organs, which is kind of significant. Transplant doctors could now legitimately view human body parts as commodities on the open market. Now, this occurred, let's see, there was the a consensus group at Harvard University back in 1968 who decided that there should they created a new category of death called brain death. And so we see from 1968 to 1980 and then 81 that this ruling by the Supreme Court said, yeah, it's okay. We can do that. Okay, we're going to a break. We'll be right back.
You are tuned in to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Visit our website by going to republicbroadcasting.org.
Don't give yourselves to brutes, men who despise you, enslave you, tell you what to do, what to think and what to feel, who drill you, diet you, treat you like cattle. Don't give yourselves to these unnatural men.
All right, we are back. This is Deanna, and I am subbing for Clint tonight, and you may join the chatters in two chat rooms, and those chat rooms are corporationnation.chatango.com and spingola.chatango.com. We will take calls at 800-313-9443, and we will take email questions at comment@spingola.com. So, who are the justices who wrote this? Well, it was Chief Justice Warren E. Burger, and he wrote the decision and was joined by Potter Stewart, Harry Blackman, William Rehnquist, and John Paul Stevens. And, of course, during this time, all kinds of things were occurring medically at this time. 1973, we had the Supreme Court okaying abortion. So if you look at things in a timeline, I love timelines because timelines allow us to see the relativity of certain events, and it's just very, I think, very revealing to look at timelines. Anyway, the Bayh-Dole and Stevenson-Whittler Acts of 1980 allowed the pharmaceutical companies to license and profit from NIH-financed research. In other words, research that the taxpayer paid for. Just turn all of this stuff over to the pharmaceutical companies. Let them make all of this money. After that, the number of biomedical patents increased dramatically. Certain individuals in the industry, including the chemical business, licensed numerous new technologies, claiming proprietary protection that essentially further limited the distribution of scientific material and the investigation of new scientific indications. The law implied that drugs licensed from academic institutions would be available inasmuch as the government financed the research. The pharmaceutical industry, the academic medical centers, the NIH, and Congress seem to have either forgotten or are simply ignoring those stipulations in favor of their corporate cronies. Now, Congress passed the Bayh-Dole Act in a lame duck session, and it took effect on December 12th. It reversed 35 years of public policy. This unique legislation to more effectively invest the $75 billion a year that the government spent in research and development allowed, number one, nonprofit organizations such as universities to retain Title II and market the inventions they created using federal research funds, and two, federal agencies to grant exclusive licenses for federally owned inventions to provide more incentive to businesses. Amazing. Okay, let me check, see if there's any callers, no callers. If you have questions or comments, feel free to call in at 800-313-9443. So anyway, we see that the government is just literally handing over potential profits to corporations that they are deeply in bed with. And then, of course, you know the government, the United States, is a corporation, and that the government invests a lot of money into the pharmaceutical industry. Okay, the act and the court decision allowing individuals and universities to patent biological things ignited greed among academic administrators and their faculties. They envisioned their medical laboratories as vehicles of revenue and their professors as entrepreneurs. By 1995, university researchers assisted in the founding of 1,633 new companies. In 1997, Stanford University researchers obtained 128 new patents, founded 15 companies, and received $52 million by licensing products. Now, there are hundreds of academic scientists, including many who had once looked at the pharmaceutical industry with skepticism, and they have walked down from their ivory towers and into the boardrooms of corporate America. With Bayh-Dole, which is ongoing and even more pervasive and destructive, there no longer exists any protection for individuals against corporatocracy. The corporations have dehumanized humanity and view people as merely a vehicle for massive profits. The pharmaceutical industry finds and funnels money into the pockets of influential academics, medical perception managers, or key opinion leaders, KOLs. Other physicians look to KOLs for scientifically backed opinions without an inkling that the information might be ineffectual or even dangerous to their patients. Opinions are just that, and are not always supported by scientific evidence. KOLs function in the establishment of a consensus in many areas of society. The drug companies, those that the FDA is supposed to scrutinize and regulate, supply most of the FDA's financing, which is the reason for its utter abandonment of public safety. Incrementally, since its inception, the FDA has evolved into the drug industry's lackey to maximize its profits. Now, the FDA, dedicated to protecting Big Pharma, is totally compromised and unwilling to protect the American public. Okay, let's take Steve from California. Steve, welcome.
Hello. Question. I just want to clarify something. I had an ex-girlfriend. I lived down in Florida. She went to Florida State, and she was a researcher working on her PhD, and so she dealt with the NIH quite a bit, getting grant money. Now, I just want to kind of clarify this, if this is the fact. So when she applied for grant money through the NIH and she got a lump sum, her research, when she found something that could be used for human, she definitely did not own any of that research. I guess I assume that the university, the Florida State University, owned that research, even though she was a researcher, and they would then market that off to the pharmaceuticals. Is that correct?
Yes.
Wow.
Yes. The government, the NIH would give money to universities, And the scholars, the people, scientists would develop a drug, and then the university would receive royalties, and they would give the drug to drug companies who would then market the drug for even more money than what the royalties would amount to.
Right. So the researcher received nothing whatsoever.
Nothing.
Wow. That is amazing. I did not know at the time when she was doing all this. She was always talking about how hard it was to get the NIH drug money and the money to do her research, but she ended up getting it most every time. And in the year she spent working at Florida State, working on some kind of neuroscience. So wow, that is amazing. So they take all the benefit.
Right.
And the researcher gets nothing. Amazing.
Right.
I didn't know that.
And of course, Big Pharma is the one that really makes off with all the billions of dollars. After the taxpayer has funded, they fund.
You know, I'm amazed that foreign pharmaceuticals haven't jumped on this with some kind of benefit to researchers to say, you know what, you're not getting any share of this, and you should. And taking away some really good ideas and good patents in the future to saying, well, you know, we can give you something for your hard work and your research versus the drug companies here in the United States. They're just going to take your stuff and make huge amounts of money. I'm surprised the foreign pharmaceutical market has not jumped on that and kind of push away the NIH, because the NIH is in business for the pharmaceuticals, the big pharmaceuticals.
What?
They're not giving Sherry anything at all with the researchers who do all the hard work. And I'm just surprised that the foreign entity pharmaceuticals have not jumped on that to say, you know, and steal away a lot of good things that, you know, for their people or, you know, in general.
Well, now, of course, when we backtrack and look at some of the earlier information that I presented in the first hour, the FDA now has offices in a lot of the foreign countries. In fact, they have, well, they've pretty much spread their tentacles throughout the world. And then when you consider the World Health Organization, see, this is not a U.S. The drug industry is not really just centered, of course, in the United States.
Right.
They are, when the military goes into a foreign country, they impose certain policies on the foreign country, mm-hmm. and really they get them heavily. Well, they say, okay, this is what we want to do to your kids. We want to vaccinate your kids. We want to vaccinate your wives. We want to do this. We want to give you this drug. We want to do it. This is worldwide objectives here. It isn't just exclusively something that they want to stay in America.
Right. Speaking of that, vaccines, I received something today. I did John Stadmiller and Michael Rivera and a couple others, but regarding an interview that John F. Kennedy Jr. did, the environmentalist lawyer, had done regarding vaccines, childhood vaccines. I will send that to you. It came to me today. It's about a 16-minute video to watch, and it is very, really interesting what he's come up with. I guess he has a book on Thermoseal.
Thimerosal.
I'll send that to you. Take a look at that and watch that, and you can probably use that for some information for one of your shows. But I was pretty amazed by watching that video, and that the government representative was definitely, you know, he's on the payroll. He's going to say what they tell him to say, but he stumbled quite a bit when John F. Kennedy Jr. pulled out that one of the bigwigs evidently had asked for whistleblower status to be protected and asked to be subpoenaed by Congress, and he was one of the heads of the CDC to say, I've offered up 1,000-plus pages showing that these childhood immunizations are linked to autism. We know that, and we've kind of cherry-picked stuff to put on our own CDC website, but here's the truth, and I want protection, and I will tell you what you need to know. I'll send that your way, so you get a chance, read that, and maybe respond back to me if you can.
Sure, be happy to. Thank you.
Thanks, Deanna.
All righty. Take care. Okay, let's take Stefan in Connecticut. Stefan, am I pronouncing your name correctly?
Hello, how are you?
I'm good, and you?
Happy. What can we talk about tonight?
Pardon me?
What can we talk about tonight?
I was
thinking that I was on the show now.
Yes, you are. You are. You've called in. Do you have a question about some of the information that I have presented or something relevant?
You know, I think they have connected me in the wrong way. I think I wanted to talk to Manny.
Okay.
Manny, yeah. You know Manny?
Yes, of course. Manny with RBN? Yes.
But they still can talk about something. If I'm online, just ask me a question.
Well, you're supposed to call in to ask me questions or talk about something that that I've presented.
Okay, then I'm asking a question. Do you know about Finca Bayano in Panama?
About what?
Finca Bayano. This is something like a place where you can survive when things get tough in the United States. Finca Bayano. You go to www.fincabayano.com.
Okay. All right. How does that relate to what we're talking about? Okay, think about that's in Panama, and you were an advertiser with RBN for a while.
Yes, I was. Do you remember that?
Not really.
Yes, I was an advertiser, and I had paid until the beginning of June, and I just realized that they had taken my ad off, and that my ad was not on.
I think that's something that you need to talk to the office about rather than call into a program that has absolutely nothing whatsoever to do with what you're talking about. So, anyway, thank you for your phone call. And Panama is definitely a very nice place, and if anybody wants to go there, I'm sure that that would be good. Alrighty, if you have calls that or questions about some of the information that we're talking about, please feel free to call in at 800-313-9443. And we also, of course, invite you to visit the chat rooms, which are corporationnation.chatango.com or spingola.chatango.com. And we're also taking questions via my email, which is comment@spingola.com. So let me just check our email and see. Let's take Curtis in Georgia. Curtis, welcome to the program.
Hey, Deanna. It's good to hear from you. It's been a while.
Yes. Thank you for your phone call.
Yeah, I wanted to comment. I've come in on a late date. I wanted to mention Aaron Schwartz. Are you familiar with him?
Aaron Schwartz, what does he do? What did he do?
He was supposedly committed suicide, and it falls right in line with what's going on with what you're talking about. He was a computer prodigy, and you can look him up on YouTube.
Okay.
He invented a lot of different programs and whatnot, but he got made wealthy by selling one of his programs. He started becoming a community activist. He broke into PACER, which is the federal database. Actually didn't break into it, but he actually helped a gentleman who was trying to take back the people's public access to the federal court system. And that's what PACER does. It actually records all the federal lawsuits that's going on across the nation. He invented a program that when people would go out and download a lawsuit off of the website, that it actually took that document and put it into a hard drive and they could access it for free. And that innovated and actually revolutionized PACER and helped a lot of people, and that's why a lot of lawsuits and whatnot, the federal government is becoming harder and harder against the government itself. the next move he made was he went into this, I think this is where it ties in with what you're talking about. He went in and found out that all the universities are actually stealing the people who are doing their doctorate theses and not letting this knowledge go to the people. And so he went in and started taking the information off of the web, off of the mainframes, and the federal government went in and prosecuted him when they caught him doing this, and supposedly he committed suicide in the middle of a trial. So,
wow.
Yeah. It's very interesting. The video on Aaron Swartz is on YouTube. It's probably about an hour, hour and a half long, but it's worth watching.
Okay. Well, I know that there's a lot of scientific data that is produced that is concealed. I know that there are a lot of scientists who have been, biologists who have, disappeared, been suicided. And one must ask, what's going on here? So, interesting.
Anyway,
thank you.
I thought I would share that. So, it's good to hear from you and keep up the good work.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Right, if you have a question or comment that's relevant, please feel free to call in at 800-313-9443. Love to hear from you. Meanwhile, the drug companies, those that the FDA is supposed to scrutinize and regulate, supply most of the FDA's financing, which is the reason for its utter abandonment of public safety. Incrementally, since its inception, the FDA has evolved into the drug industry's lackey to maximize its profits. Now, the FDA, dedicated to protecting Big Pharma, is totally uncompromised and unwilling to protect the American public. The FDA's client is the drug industry. That is who it represents. The FDA Center for Drug Evaluation and Research, the CDER, established in 1982, devotes at least 80% of its resources to the approval of new drugs and 20% to everything else. It allocates 5% to drug safety. Although Congress created what has become an uncontrollable behemoth, it will not harness the FDA. Not only that, Congress expanded the FDA's already excessive power by passing the Prescription Drug User Fee Act. That's a PDUFA, renewable every 5 years, through which drug companies would pay significant user fees to the FDA to review, approve, and expedite its drugs. So, it's just amazing what has gone on and what has happened in just a few short years. And it is just amazing to me. Alrighty, let's see. Okay. Let's take Jerry in Texas.
Hello, Diana. I don't know if you or your listeners
know about this. Hi, Russ. How are you?
But did you know, Diana, that there is actually a cure for cancer which has been discovered, but it is only available to the elite, and where it is being kept is locked under lock and key in this vault at the Rockefeller Center. Are you aware of this?
Well, Russ, there are a lot of cures for cancer, a lot of cures, and but if the FDA and the drug companies were to allow those cures, and there are a lot of them, and many of them are natural, and they work, but they're not profitable. So, of course...
Why do they keep them locked in the vault at the Rockefeller Center?
I don't know that they're locked in a vault at the Rockefeller Center. That's just speculation on your part. Well, they're not locked anywhere. They're readily available to anybody online that wants to do the research. They're readily available from naturopathic physicians and from various sources. And I'm sure that the Rockefellers and other elites are aware of those cures. In fact, I believe that they probably use those cures, because you don't see them getting these diseases that the rest of the population seems to be getting. Anyway, Russ, we always enjoy your calls, so thank you so much for calling. Okay, we will take your phone call at 800-313-9443. Anyway, that's interesting. But when you look at the elite, I mean, they really don't get sick very often. They live to be, to ripe old ages. In 1992, due to the pharmaceuticals' criticism of the FDA's approval time for new drugs, they passed the PDUFA, which is the Prescription Drug User Fee Act. And what that is that the company that applies for FDA approval of its products must pay an application fee. Initially, this fee was $310,000 per drug, which the FDA utilized to increase its staff by 1,500 new drug industry paid employees by 2002. By 2004, the fee was $576,000 per drug. The user fees soon accounted for approximately half of the FDA's drug evaluation budget. The fast-growing pharmaceutical industry, with its many chemical preparations, now subsidizes the FDA, the very agency that it is supposed to be protecting the population. And with all this money flowing into it from the drug industry, there's a huge conflict of interest. And who do you think that they are going to sponsor? Who do you think they're going to support? So, President George H.W. Bush signed this act into law on October 29th, 1992. Now remember that the Bushes have a lot to do with drugs, always have, whether trafficking them, having wars to bring drugs out of Afghanistan, consider all the drugs that were trafficked during the Vietnam War. This war typically is not about imposing or spreading democracy. It really has a lot to do with, drug trafficking, illegal drugs, of course. Anyway, in 2005, the FDA increased its user fees, this is amazing, to $295 million. 55% of the new employees were in positions where they would review new drug approvals. Okay, we'll be right back and we'll take more phone calls.
Hi, neighbor. Welcome again to this neighborhood. I'd like to show you something. You know what this is? Maybe if I press this button.
There are so many things.
All righty, this is Deanna. and I am subbing for Clint tonight, and, well, for the rest of the week, actually. We do have some more callers. Let's take Eric in California. Eric, welcome to the program.
Hi, Deanna.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great. How are you?
Good.
I hope this is relevant enough to your topic. I just can't believe the things that they put in those vaccines. I mean, if you knew what was in those vaccines, I don't think you'd go near them. For example, there is human diploid cells, including DNA and proteins from various aborted fetal tissues, human albumin from blood, rhesus monkey, fetal living cells, continuous cloned line of monkey kidney cells, rhesus monkey fetal diploid cells, simian cancer virus -40, and at least 79 others similar to that, vesicle fluid from calf skins, calf serum, bovine fetal serum, U.S.-sourced bovine extract, washed cheap red blood cells, child embryo, chick embryonic fluid, chick protein, mouse serum, proteins, guinea pig embryo cells, shark squalene, gelatin, hydrolyzed gelatin, processed gelatin, lactose, and others. And these are just a few of the ingredients that you have been infected with by stingers called needles. And I reference that from Clint Richardson's reality blogspot. That's where I got that list of ingredients. And it's pretty horrifying. And yet they're selling them like they're candy. And every Walmart and Walgreens and everywhere you go, they have these signs up. Vaccinations. Get your vaccines. Get your vaccines.
Right.
So I hope
and of course, the doctors promote them. Pediatricians particularly, most of the money that they make comes from giving vaccines to infants, getting, you know, that come in for their well baby checkups. And you can go to the CDC website and look at the list. And yet the government relies on people not looking at these official documents, not looking at the official records, but simply believing their doctors. And those doctors are approved by the American Medical Association. And they get, and unless they promote these vaccines, unless they promote the what is called the standard of care, then they can lose their license. But yeah, there's a lot of really bad things in vaccines. In addition to mercury which bypasses the blood-brain barrier, and can kill you. I mean, it's
we get enough mercury from our amalgam fillings too.
Absolutely, sure. Wow. Thank you so much. Did you have some other things to contribute or ask
no,
a question?
No, thanks. I guess that was it.
Well, thank you for calling in. And listeners, don't get vaccinated. Okay? Alrighty, let's take Joe in Missouri. Joe, welcome to the program.
Hi, Deanne. Can you hear me?
Yes. Thank you.
I know it's kind of an easy target, but it seems to fit right in with what you've been talking about. Of course, you mentioned them a couple times tonight, but it strikes me that maybe the whatever act that they basically put in that you were referring to maybe in the early 80s that reversed the 35 years of not patenting living organisms, also probably had something to do with laying the groundwork with not just the drug side of the FDA equation, but the food side of the FDA equation with Monsanto.
Mm-hmm.
and the fact that that sort of paved the way for them being able to patent all these sort of living things, so-called. but the other thing that I thought, two things about Monsanto. Number one, you know, they were involved in making the Agent Orange back
right.
in the 60s, and at that point, they were defense contractors.
Yeah.
So, and then you kind of flash forward, and now, oh, they're going to save the world through, you know, this sort of advanced technological farming.
Sure.
But I guess what I wanted to point out was that I think it's in the 90s, and I wish I'd kind of had time to pull the specifics up, but I think people can get to it and find out for themselves that who had been the head attorney for Monsanto for a very long time, right in the thick of the GMO period of time, stepped down and then was appointed the head of the FDA. And I want to say that this was perhaps under one of the Bush administrations, but it might have been Carter, actually, or excuse me, Clinton.
Sure.
But regardless, this is stuff that can be verified, that you basically had the high-ranking Monsanto attorney at one point, then later becoming the head of the FDA. I mean, is this not a fairly blatant...
Indeed.
You know, conflict of interest, I guess is what I was trying to say.
Sure.
I mean, it seems absurd in a way, and then through the FDA turning a blind eye, Monsanto was able to do all this sort of, just say that they did their own in-house safety testing on GMOs of various kinds.
Sure.
That allowed them to get put out there. So anyways, I don't know if that's entirely on topic, but it seems to be similar to the topic you've been talking about.
Oh, absolutely. And I think the part of the process of the Vietnam War, part of the policies practiced there by Monsanto with their Agent Orange, I think that was probably a clinical trial to see how Agent Orange affected people. And because, I mean, there were like 3 million people killed, 3 million Vietnamese killed, and then they were also spraying this over the U.S. military, who then came home very, very, very ill with a lot of problems, and their children have a lot of problems. And I've had guests on my program, talking about this situation. And then you have the same kind of situation in Iraq, where you have the vaccines that they receive and Gulf War syndrome. You have to ask, gosh, is this the clinical trials? Is this some sort of a process where they can eliminate the people who would fight against tyranny within our government? Are they destroying those people on purpose? What's going on here? In addition to trafficking drugs, they seem to also be destroying a lot of lives. Not just out-and-out murder, but long-lasting sicknesses.
Well, and again, in both cases, you had, with Agent Orange, Monsanto, who did the in-house safety and clinical testing on its effect on humans, saying, there's not a problem. There's not a problem for our guys to be exposed with this. And that's the same folks that are doing the in-house testing with regard to GMOs.
Right.
And saying, exactly. There's not a problem. There's not a problem with Roundup Ready. And
right.
Now you're able to go in and see that basically all these fetuses in utero, if you do tests, have Roundup Ready in them.
Sure.
I mean,
glyphosate.
Humans are basically getting this stuff, as you said, going through a blood barrier and so forth. It just seems to be another avenue, you know, the pharmaceutical. It seems like big pharma and big agro, it's the same players and the same FDA that's supposed to be protecting and holding the line on all this. And also, is it maybe not also these NGOs or whatever, these non-governmental organizations that are able to kind of promote this stuff on a weird sort of step around local government and kind of do a world promotion of a lot of this stuff.
Sure.
But sure. Anyways, just some observations, and I was hoping it was relevant to what you were saying. I know Monsanto tends to be an easy target, but it's amazing to me that they're such an easy target and they've got such a in-your-face thing going on in history, but people, by and large, out on the street, if you will, just seem to shrug it off. No big deal.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. So it's pretty awful. They go from killing people in one way to killing people in another way, or at least making them really, really sick. And, of course, the pharmaceutical industry is in business to make profit. So in order to make profit, you need a lot of sick people who will use the pharmaceuticals. So.
Wow. Well, I hadn't really thought about that, but that, you just hit the nail on the head. You need to have Monsanto make people sick so that the big pharma can, oh, you're not feeling well, you're losing energy, you're bloated, this, that, or the other.
Yeah.
So we've got a series of pharmaceuticals that you can take. If you look at the list, and if, as long as your eyes don't bleed and you don't, you know, organs don't fall out and this kind of stuff, which might happen, but yeah, you can take this pill and it'll make you feel better from the way Monsanto made you feel.
Maybe, yeah. Maybe it will. Maybe it'll kill you too. But anyway, well, they make a profit.
They have to find just the right slow kill, right? It just like they probably have these number crunching guys. It's like we just need to keep them alive. Here's the most profitable model. You know, they make it to 57, and we hit them with this. You know, the food, and then they're on a lifelong litany of these drugs and. If we can get them to 57, anything beyond that, we're in the green or something like that. I don't know.
And, of course, Russ brought up the cancer industry, which is very, very profitable. They're never going to reveal that there are lots of cures, and those cures are very reasonably, well, they're natural. But they keep them alive and charge thousands of dollars a month for chemo or radiation. They keep them alive long enough to get maximum profit.
Nuclear medicine is about the most mind-bending term I think I've ever, ballsy, kind of out-in-your-face language manipulation I've ever heard. Because when I was growing up, you know, if you sat in front of a tube television as a kid, they said, hey, don't get too close. That causes, you know, that radiation will cause cancer. But then flash forward and, oh, no, that's the very thing that's going to cure you with some of that nuclear medicine.
Sure. Yeah.
Well, anyways, thanks. You've been very gracious. I hope I contributed, but
yes, you
great,
have.
Great
thank
show
you.
And good topic. And you've had to field some interesting callers a little earlier on, so good job with that. So.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Joe. All righty. Take care. Let's take Mike in New Jersey. Mike?
Well, how you doing?
Good, and you?
Very good. I'd like to share some personal vaccination stories that I have. My one co-worker who I really respect, she's all organic. She's very health conscious and everything. And then about every season she goes for a flu shot. Called her out. I was like, you spend all this money eating all this organic food, and then you just shoot stuff directly into your bloodstream. You have no idea. You don't even want to look it up. You have no idea the agenda that these people are pushing. And I just find it funny that she's not trusting the food industry, but she'll just take injections every, you know, I don't know how often people get flu shots. I've never really got one. I don't know, like multiple times a year, I would think.
I think they only give them out like once, or I'm not sure. But Dr. Daniels, on one of her recent programs, says for the last 20 years that the CDC has admitted that, oh gosh, we developed the wrong flu vaccine, and it doesn't work for this particular flu that's going around this year. So, whoops. Well,
yeah, they have to predict the strain of the virus in there. I did hear about that, and it's like it's admitted it doesn't work. It's admitted it's dangerous. It's admitted it gives you sick. I mean, but it's so funny. Like sometimes when people are talking about it, I just pretend I'm the government agent. I just go, safe and effective, and then whatever they say, I just say safe and effective.
And it does have mercury in it.
Yeah, but mercury's good for you, you know. Safe and effective.
Well, unless you drop it on the floor, then you have to call in hazmat and have to clean it up. But
sure,
it's okay
but
to put it in your veins.
But if you inject it in you, then it's safe and effective. So.
Yeah, right.
My other little caveat to that is when I was in high school, I'd say about maybe, I don't know, 10th grade, 11th grade, stepped on a rusty nail, and I got a tetanus shot. And I got super violently ill. I was hallucinating, and all my veins in my body, like, rose to the surface.
Oh, my gosh.
I thought I was allergic to the tetanus shot, you know, for years, and I even told doctors, not that I really go to the doctor much, because I don't really trust them, honestly. And, anyway, fast forward, I was just, you know, it stuck in my mind, and so I did some Googling, and I was searching about tetanus shots from, you know, 10 years ago, and lo and behold, it was stacked with a mad cow, some kind of mad cow.
Oh, my gosh.
Or, vaccine. Yeah, it could have been that that got me super sick. And ever since, you know, having that experience, I've never, I just don't even trust that whole branch of medicine. I go to the chiropractor, I'll go to acupuncture, I'll do almost anything before I go to drugs or a mainstream doctor. They spend 3 minutes with you. They know nothing about nutrition. They know nothing. I mean, I've heard on other people talk about how they get mind controlled. They're thrown in school for 10 hours a day, cramming information, not sleeping for years, and they're essentially in a cult with their white robes.
Sure.
They know everything. And, like my parents are older people and they just believe everything they say. They'll do anything they say. My mom takes the flu shot. I told her, you know, 10 times and she doesn't want to look into it. She doesn't want to read about it. She just trusts them wholeheartedly. You know, they are the priest and the white lab coat. Nothing they can do is wrong.
Okay, Mike, we are going to a quick break, and so thank you so much for calling in. We'll be right back.
And the men who hold high places must be the ones who start to mold a new reality closer to the heart, closer to the heart.
All righty. This is Deanna, and I am subbing for Clint tonight. Let's take Jeff in Idaho.
Hi, Deanna. Can you hear me?
Sure.
Hi. Hey, I put something in the chat room. Dr. K said he had a thing of Lyme, and it looked like a weaponized syphilis, like with the Tuskegee. It might have been some from the Tuskegee Airmen. Yeah, I haven't had a chance to download your new book on Kindle, but I was going to try and do it this week. Did you put anything? Did you have anything like that in the new book?
No.
Oh, okay.
No.
Okay. I've been trying to help Dr. Parker with some of his stuff on some of the Dr. Clark issues, and if I come across some stuff, I'll try and email him. But I think I found a connection to the Pandora's box thing, if you look in the chat room.
Okay.
Yeah. So,
which one are you in?
I'm in Clint's chat.
Okay.
Okay. All right. Nice talking to you. Thanks. See you, bye.
Nice talking with you. All righty. If you have a question or would like to make a comment, feel free to call in at 800-313. I'm sorry. I just got some really bad news. Call in 800-313-9443. We're talking about corporations and some of the FDA, and about how the medications that people take for the diseases that they have. And I think that I've listened to a lot of programs from Dr. Daniels, and she's talked a lot about about diabetes, and that often the very treatment itself is the very thing that kills you. So, anyway, I do want to mention my own program, which is on Saturday, and that is between 3 and 6 p.m. And this Saturday, let's see who have I got this Saturday, we are going to have, gosh, who am I going to have on? Got to look at my schedule. But we are going to be talking about something very interesting. Well, we try to always have something very interesting. But anyway, my program is on Saturday between 3 and 6 p.m. That's Central Time. And there's a lot of really good programming on RBN, and I hope that people will support RBN and tune in and listen to the programs. You can learn an awful lot that is applicable to your own life. And do keep in mind that, well, doctors can be very, very dangerous, and the FDA is not in place to protect you. It is in place to protect the corporations. So, thank you for listening tonight, and I will be back tomorrow night. Thanks so much.